News.
Today is Tuesday, February 15th. Both the German Chancellor and the chair of the OSCE are in Moscow as part of an ongoing diplomatic effort to reduce tensions between Russia and Ukraine.
The Russian president said that although the United States and NATO responses didn't answer Russia's concerns, he said they contained ideas that we are not against discussing.
Plus, the geopolitical implications as tensions continue.
Right now, what Russia's looking to do is to fundamentally rewrite the rules of the post-war order in Europe.
And how the standoff could affect Africa. We'll have these stories and more ahead. From the Voice of America, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said that he welcomed signals from Moscow on Tuesday that Russia is keeping the diplomatic door open to resolve tensions along Ukraine's border.
Russia has amassed a fighting force in and around Ukraine unprecedented since the Cold War. Everything is now in place for a new attack. But Russia still has time to step back from the brink, stop preparing for war, and start working for a peaceful solution.
In Moscow, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz met with Russian President Vladimir Putin as the Polish foreign minister, who happens to also be the chair of the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, Zbigniew Rau, met with Sergei Lavrov, his Russian counterpart. Henry Ridgewell is closely watching these developments, and I asked him what came out of these sessions.
As you say, this is a flurry of diplomacy we're seeing in recent days. Olaf Scholz, the German chancellor, is the latest in a series of visits to Moscow by Western leaders in a bid really to try to keep diplomacy alive. And the rhetoric from this meeting, I suppose you could say encouraging, given what has passed in recent days. The Russian president, Vladimir Putin, said that although the United States and NATO responses didn't answer Russia's concerns, he said they contained ideas that we are not against discussing. And so that's a marked change in rhetoric, in tone, really, from recent days where the rhetoric has been very bellicose. It's been all about what NATO and the West are not doing and failing to answer Russia's demands. On Olaf Scholz's part, he said that Western leaders, it was their duty that they must work harder to prevent war in Europe, that it was unthinkable for his generation, for this generation of Europeans, to see conflict on the continent again. But it was evident there are major uncertainties. You know, that's the major caveat hanging over these positive signs.
Henry, what can you tell us about the position of Russian troops, whether they be in Belarus or along the Ukrainian border?
Russia does still have well over 100,000 troops surrounding the borders with Ukraine, to the north, to the east, and to the south. The military exercises with Belarus are ongoing, as are exercises in Crimea, which was, of course, forcefully seized from Ukraine in 2014. And Putin made it clear that the withdrawal of troops that we've seen, and the defense ministry has released video of tanks being loaded onto railway trucks to be taken away from the front line, that was only partial. And Western intelligence services, and indeed the British defense ministry this afternoon, has made it clear that those preparations for a possible invasion of Ukraine are very much still in play, that Russia is producing, is constructing field hospitals on the border with Ukraine, and that the withdrawal so far, such as it is only been very partial and only slightly back from the front lines. So an extremely tense moment still, but perhaps some hope that the diplomacy will continue in the coming days.
Henry, that wasn't the only diplomatic meeting that was taking place in Moscow today. Zbigniew Rau, who's the Polish foreign minister, was meeting with the Russian foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov. What can you tell us about the outcome of that meeting?
Yes, these are different parallel tracks of diplomacy, if you like. Of course, the one that matters most is what President Putin is saying and who he's meeting. And he most of all wants to speak to President Joe Biden and the head of NATO. That's what Russia wants ultimately. But in the meantime, the West is presenting a united front. The Polish foreign minister is currently also the chair of the OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, which is a membership organization that includes Russia, that was set up to try to create a forum exactly for these kind of tensions, to avoid this kind of situation. And so Foreign Minister Rao was in Moscow. He proposed a new dialogue on security in Europe through the OSCE with Russia to Sergei Lavrov, the Russian foreign minister, who said it was interesting but didn't go further than that, and clearly stated that dialogue with NATO and the United States is more important. So some hope again that Sergei Lavrov, who has played a major role in the current negotiations and diplomacy as well, that he is also hinting that there is room for more negotiations, that there might be room for an agreement, but by no means anything certain.
Have there been any indications on what next steps may be?
Seems to be a bit of a stalemate and unclear where things go from here, because Russia is saying that the West is not answering its demands, its specific requirements. And this came up today again, that Ukraine does not join NATO. The West, meanwhile, is saying we're not shifting on our policy, that NATO has an open door for new members. So where does this go from here? We learned that Joe Biden is speaking to Emmanuel Macron this afternoon. There are other channels of diplomacy open as well. Sergei Lavrov speaking to other foreign ministers in Europe. But as we've seen in recent weeks, the situation is changing by the day, by the hour.
Henry, one last question. The State Duma, the legislative body in Russia, voted today to recommend to President Putin that he recognize the separatist areas in Ukraine. What exactly does that mean in the context of this situation?
This is key because in 2014, of course, when Russia forcefully seized Crimea from Ukraine, it also backed pro-Russian rebels in the eastern region of Donbass, in the districts of Donetsk and Luhansk. And those rebels still control that area. Indeed, Ukraine has always maintained that Russian troops were part of the forces that ejected Ukrainian government forces from that region. And the conflict has kept on going at a low level. Ever since 2014, more than 13,000 of people have died in the conflict. It just has not been in the headlines, really, in recent years. There has been much speculation that the first stage of any Russian invasion into Ukraine would be for Russian troops to fully control those areas, and they would be clearly welcomed by Donetsk and Luhansk. The rebel administrations that run those areas have indeed asked Putin to do exactly that. Now, what happened in the Duma today was that lawmakers, which, of course, the Putin party has a majority there, voted overwhelmingly in favor of a motion calling on the president to recognize those districts of Donetsk and Luhansk as independent, as breakaway regions, no longer part of Ukraine. In the press conference he gave with Olaf Scholz, President Putin said he would not go that far. He said, "We will do everything to solve the problem in Donbass. But we will do this, first of all, based on the unrealized possibilities of the Minsk agreement." Now, that's an agreement whereby that Donbass region would have some level of independence, and against which Kiev, the Ukrainian government, is pushing back very hard. And really, that's at the root of much of this diplomatic activity in recent months. Boiled down to what it could mean for the conflict, well, it could be that President Putin uses this as leverage, as a threat against the West, to say, if you don't move on our demands, then we will recognize formally the independence of the Donbass region. And that would likely trigger greater conflict in those regions. You would likely see some response both from Russia and Ukraine to that. And of course, that kind of conflict is exactly what the Europeans and NATO and the United States are trying to avoid. So essentially, it's another a piece of ammunition, in President Putin's diplomatic armor that he can bring to the West and threaten them with.
Henry Ridgewell is in London. Thank you very much for your reporting today.
Good to speak to you.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken also spoke with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. The secretary reiterated the United States' commitment to continue to pursue a diplomatic solution. You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Miller. With the German chancellor in Moscow meeting with the Russian president to try and find a diplomatic solution to end the tension between Russia, Ukraine, and the West, how has the situation affected the region's geopolitics? Andrew Lawson is a fellow in the Europe, Russia, and Eurasia program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and has been monitoring the situation. I begin our conversation by asking him how the current situation is likely to affect the geopolitics of the region in the near future.
Well, I think right now we're looking at the possibility of entering a time of deep uncertainty. Right now, what Russia's looking to do is to fundamentally rewrite the rules of the post-war order in Europe. And so what that means is that if we can't count on Russia to respect the sovereignty of states, the peaceful resolution of disputes, and the right of Ukraine to determine its own policy path, then we run the risk of increased conflict in the region. Certainly, there would have to be a NATO response to any Russian attack, which would potentially lead us to a spiral of escalation. As Russia has said repeatedly, it views NATO as a malign power intent on restricting Russia's rise. So, I think the implications of this conflict, should things get any worse on the border with Russia and Ukraine, are quite severe and is really leading us into some frightening unknown.
Andrew, those are some of the short-term implications, but as someone who looks at this, mm-hmm. what do you see as some of the longer-term implications?
Well, I think one of the big questions, of course, is will Russia succeed in changing changing Ukraine's policy path? Will Russia decide to send in forces to occupy Ukraine? And then what will the Ukrainian state look like as a result? Another question that is this question raises is what happens in terms of NATO force posture in its eastern flank? Certainly, the easternmost members of NATO are looking for reassurance that it can count on support from other allies in case Russia pushes forward with even more aggressions, even more irredentist claims. So that's also something to watch out for. And then the question, finally, is what happens with Belarus? Belarus right now is being used essentially as a staging ground for a potential attack on Ukraine. If it gets drawn into this conflict, then Belarus would move much more deeply into alignment with Russia, and would kind of expand this from a bilateral conflict to very much a regional one, where Poland, Lithuania, other countries that are bordering Belarus are going to be very concerned about what that means for their own security.
Andrew, diplomatic efforts are, of course, still underway to try and de-escalate the situation. But as someone who watches this, what do you see as some of the key calculations each respective party, whether it be members of the European Union, Ukraine, Russia, the United States, what do you see as some of the key calculations they are making as these discussions continue?
Well, I think for Putin, the calculation is what can he get away with? Certainly he's put a lot of policy objectives on the table, making this simultaneously about obtaining security guarantees from NATO and the West, while also trying to influence Ukraine's policy by force. So I think, some of the key calculations that are going through Putin's mind right now are, what is achievable? How much force does he actually need to use to obtain his objectives? And what are the outcomes? And I think that for that final question, we really don't quite know what the effect would be on Russia domestically in terms of its own stability if Putin decides to go forward with a broader invasion of Ukraine. Now, at the same time, I think the calculation for the United States and the West is, what could possibly be done to avert a war without giving in to Putin's demands to rewrite the rules in Europe by force? So I think that there's two questions that are quite important, and I think what we're seeing now with these bilateral engagements with various European leaders going to Moscow to speak to Putin, are you know, different attempts to try to resolve both of those questions. The unknown for me here is you know, whether as we this crisis pushes forward, are we really on the same page with one another? When Macron and Scholz go to Moscow, are the objectives they seeking really so closely aligned with what the United States is looking to achieve? And that's a bit of an open question, I think.
Andrew, one last question before I let you go. As someone who researches this part of the world, what are you keeping a close eye on that perhaps a casual observer may not necessarily notice?
Well, I think there's certainly been a lot of attention focused on the buildup of military equipment on the border with Ukraine and in occupied Crimea. But at the same time, on the domestic front in Russia, there's plenty of important things happening. And one of them is the decision taken in the State Duma today to recommend that President Putin recognize the independence of these breakaway states in the Donetsk and Luhansk regions. This has the potential of upping the ante without firing a shot. It still gives Putin plenty of courses of action to pursue to try to claim some sort of victory in this, even if it's short of further military involvement. And also coming up this week, there's going to be a meeting in the UN Security Council dedicated to the implementation of the Minsk agreements. This is normally a forum where Russia airs grievances that Ukraine has dragged its feet on the implementation of these peace accords. But now with this this recent development with the Duma pushing for recognizing the independence of these breakaway regions, it'll be quite telling to see what are the statements coming out of the Russian delegation. This is a very new chapter in the course of the conflict.
Andrew Lawson is a fellow in the Europe, Russia, and Eurasia program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Andrew, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you very much, Steve. Have a good day.
Tensions between Russia and Ukraine have mobilized the most radical sectors of Ukrainian nationalism. From Kyiv, Ricardo Marquina has this report, which is narrated by John Spear.
With tensions over a possible war with Russia at an all-time high, Ukrainian civilians receive military training every weekend. In an abandoned former Soviet military facility in the suburbs of Kyiv, men and women learn how to use firearms and what to do in an urban conflict. Ivan, who declined to give his surname, is a war veteran who is serving as a drill instructor in this exercise. We are calm. If necessary, we will return to defend our country. We work on it, see? It's the weekend and we've come to train. The training is not organized by the Ukrainian armed forces, but by one of the most active battalions during the war in the east of the country, the Azov Battalion, often criticized for holding far-right and even neo-Nazi positions. Now, this organization has stepped into politics by creating the National Core Party. Its leaders refuse to be classified as ultra-nationalists or extremists and define themselves as patriots in times of war. Maxim Zorin is one of the party's leaders. We position ourselves as Ukrainian nationalists, but we have to understand that the nationalist right in Ukraine is very different from that of Europe or the US. We have other priorities. We face other problems. The biggest of those priorities that we need to resolve is the war with the Russian Federation. For Ukraine's sizable Jewish minority, largely concentrated in the eastern city of Dnepr, worries about the growth of the far right were highest during the 2013 so-called Maidan protests. But when stability returned, and with a new leadership in power, concerns about nationalist extremism abated. Zelig Brez is director of the Dnepropetrovsk Jewish community. And he says that while these fringe groups do exist, radicals make up only a small part of Ukrainian society.
We believe that it's not a major mainstream part of the political environment. And the common sense and the people with the very good feelings and support and friendship and tolerance is very strong in Ukraine. So these groups exist, but they comprise a very minor percentage of the society.
Russian propaganda has portrayed these far-right groups as a fundamental part of Ukraine's politics. But a coalition, all the far-right parties failed to make it into the Ukrainian parliament in the last legislative elections. Kira Rudik heads the Liberal Holos, or Voice, party.
The amount of people who are supporting really far-right movements is fairly small. So there is no far-right party in the Ukrainian parliament, and the latest polls are showing that people are not giving them enough support. So what we are seeing is just created by the society, limited group of people who are far right, which I believe would happen in any democratic country.
The possibility of a large-scale armed conflict persists, and some fear this can give wings to Ukrainian nationalism, including its most radical sectors. For Ricardo Marquina in Kiev, John Speer, VOA News.
South Africa has a firm eye on what's happening in Ukraine, because Moscow has been strongly allied to South Africa's ruling African National Congress, or the ANC, since the days of apartheid, when the then Soviet Union provided money, weapons, and military training to the ANC's armed wing. But analysts say, more than anything else, what's most concerning to the South African government is the harm that a full-blown war could do, not only to its beleaguered economy, but to the entire African continent. Darren Taylor has that story.
With its fertile lands, Ukraine's one of the world's most important food producers. Its maize, wheat, and vegetable oils especially feed millions of Africans. Ukraine's best agricultural land is in its eastern regions, the parts that would immediately be affected if the Russians were to invade. Economists say a war would more than likely throw global food markets into turmoil, causing price rises, potential food shortages, and possible hunger, especially in Africa. South Africa, for one, exports fruits, vegetables, nuts, and tobacco to Russia and Ukraine, which would be in jeopardy if there's conflict.
It has absolutely nothing to do with our relationship, exports and imports to and from Russia or Ukraine. It's about the interconnectedness of the global financial markets.
Dr. Ira Jabedian is one of South Africa's leading economists.
Let's imagine Russia invades Ukraine, EU responds to it, America responds to it. It can be a confrontation for the next 2 years before the markets stabilize. We're going to get another sort of torpedo in the global economic growth situation. In that scenario, oil prices and gas prices are going to go sky high. The growth in EU will definitely diminish. It will affect our exports to the EU.
The administration of President Cyril Ramaphosa isn't saying anything, at least publicly, about the unfolding situation in Eastern Europe. But behind the scenes, say insiders, it's very worried about what it considers to be one of the most dangerous points in recent global history. Abedian says the whole world should share that worry.
On the economic and social welfare side, the earth is but one country, mankind is citizens. Governments can fight, militaries can fight, but the reality of prosperity of nations, that they are interdependent, their currencies are interdependent, their economies are interdependent, is undeniable. That is the driver of the current instability in the global economy.
So far, says the economist, as world markets shake at the possibility of war in Europe, South Africa's financial arena is showing resilience, bolstered especially by mining exports and a stable rand currency.
We've had other good news. We've had the World Bank giving us a couple of billion or 11 billion. All of that adds to the inflow of foreign exchange into the country at the same time that the domestic economy is not importing as much as we used to because we are not growing, and therefore the rand has got a strength.
But Abedian says conflict in the Ukraine will almost certainly put a stop to foreign investment in emerging markets like South Africa's. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
And that's going to do it for us today. Remember, the news doesn't stop when this program ends, so stay up to date with all the latest developments from Ukraine and around the world 24 hours a day. Just point your web browser to voanews.com. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thank you very much for listening. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a good night.